stocks are seen as an asset, okay, as a thing. And an asset is technically something you buy and you're supposed to sell for more money, right? Which real estate, yeah, that's an asset. But the thing is, it's real, okay? You don't just print a house, okay? Whereas Google prints millions and billions of shares. And freaking Tesla, their shares outstanding have doubled since 2010 when they went public. They printed like 100 million shares over the past 10 years. So Ponzi asset, meaning it's literally imaginary. It takes no effort to produce, and you think it's an asset, but really you get it's not a real asset. It's something that you can only get from selling it to a bigger fool, just like you.
It's time to stop trusting the public markets and look to history's first trillionaire on how to build real, lasting wealth. Look, over the past 14 years, we've applied these exact principles in more than 300 plus transactions. Not one single investor has lost money. That trillionaire was King Solomon. We'll be sharing his wisdom on how to build wealth in a way that's translated for the 21st century investor. My name is Blake Templeton, and this is the Solomon Investor Podcast. All right, this is the Solomon Investor Podcast. I have a special guest with me today, someone who understands optics and metrics. This is Tan Lu, and he's the author of The Ponzi Factor. Now, before I get into it, I'm gonna really lay it out for you guys of who he is, so when I'm asking questions, you understand where he's coming from. But I want to tell you that the majority of people, whether it's an economics professor, whether it's someone who is in from a master of the engineer of math, or someone who's a money manager, they don't understand how the system actually works. And so the book, The Ponzi Factor, explains why today's non-dividend stocks meet the definition of a Ponzi scheme. And Tan has undergraduate degrees in both economics, finance, and a master's degree in statistics. He's worked in finance industry for 10 years. And during that time, he's worked for two different hedge funds, had a career in managing distressed assets. And man, I'm so excited to talk to you. Tell me a little bit right now about how you actually got involved in the financial space.
Thanks for having me, Blake. Initially, I got involved in finance for the same reasons a lot of young men tried to get in finance. It sounds exciting. It sounds like there's a lot of money in it. And it is exciting. Why? Because it's gambling. Okay? It's gambling. And the thing is, you think that there's a way to game the system. So like most people, I got into finance for those reasons.
Very interesting. I mean, have you always been skeptical of the market?
No, initially I loved, in fact, I was very passionate about what the stock market was in my 20s and when I first started working for my first hedge fund out of college. And I, like many people right now, think that money grows on trees. So you think that you could just create these things called stocks, shuffle it with real money, and somehow create more money for everyone to play with. Except for that idea itself from the very beginning, even in school, was a little bit shady for me. As in, even though I wanted to believe in the system, the stock market, Wall Street, part of it just never really clicked on why that makes any sense. And personally, I just thought at the moment, that time, well, this is just how things work. And I'll have these questions answered later because I'm such a novice. Except for the issue is, as I continued to work in finance, I realized those answers, those questions were never answered. In fact, they were just completely avoided by people in the industry. And they just assumed that you can indeed create things called stocks, print as many as you want as a company, and shuffle it with real money with investors, and somehow give people more money than they contribute, which makes no logical sense. So initially, one of the biggest surprises, I guess, biggest surprise when I first started working for a hedge fund is I realized that you try to game this system, but it's all gambling in the sense that there is no way to really game the system. There is no way to actually get a real definitive advantage. And and basically there was no way to really promise our clients something positive in return when we couldn't promise. but that's what we were selling, though, because there was no way for us to guarantee a really positive return or any positive return for that matter.
Okay, so let me hold on for a second. So this is while you're at the financial, at the hedge funds, right?
In the very beginning of my career, yes.
Okay, got it. And so in this time period, you're like going out, you want to give this world-class customer service,
mm-hmm.
you know, yep. you want to provide them the returns yep. that, and then you're seeing behind the curtain.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you want to sell, you know, returns. And basically what I really, really understood from that first experience, really my first year in finance, was working for that hedge fund was analysis and all that stuff was secondary, if not third. The number one goal, the number one objective every single day from the fund manager was how to get more people to invest in the fund, how to get more clients in the fund, how to sell your services to more people so they give you money. Not analysis, not anything. But the number one objective was to get money into the fund, not the research aspect of it.
Yeah, that's so interesting, because on the front side of it, if on the, mm-hmm. on the, you know, on the front of a business, you know, traffic looks good. Traffic means it's successful traffic. And so what I hear you saying is, mm-hmm. is without that traffic coming in,
mm-hmm.
then what?
Well, perhaps the most ideal situation for any hedge fund, right, is you get some people to invest and then you actually show the returns. And the thing is, most hedge funds, first of all, 90% of them, from what I understand, are actually under 10 million or under 100 million, and they basically go out of business within very, very, very quickly. But majority of those hedge funds, what they're doing is, yeah, everyone's always trying to get something positive for their clients. That's, you know, without a doubt. The question is, are they actually in control? The answer is no. And what usually happens is, oh yeah, of course we're trying to get something positive, but the number one goal is to keep getting the traffic in, as you say, keep getting more investors to invest. Because why? Because chances are you're not going to be positive, you're going to be negative. And basically the way you offset that is by getting more people in. And I will say one thing, there is one definitive advantage in finance, and that is if you have more money, okay, you can stand more losses and stuff, and you can do more things to hedge or whatever it is, right? So capital is indeed one advantage, but it is it's the truth for all kinds of investing, not just stocks, right? You have more money, you just have more advantage. So yeah, the initially, they're always about traffic, always about sales, and what I realized in that first year was, you don't have to have a degree in finance, okay? You can just be a salesperson and sell, sell, sell. In fact, from what I read an article a while back, yeah, those are the people at Goldman Sachs that make the most money. They're not people who research. They're people who sell, sell, sell. And that's what I realized in that first year of finance, is that it's all gambling, and really the day-to-day activity is not about research and analysis, but about selling and getting more people into the fund. And that was quite a disappointment to me.
Yeah, I appreciate you sharing that. And so just to kind of bring it home, okay, so my name's Bob now, and I want to kind of process this with you. I'm hearing you. I've got about $1 million, you know, with a hedge fund, and I hear you saying this, but I look at my statement, and my statement still says I have $1 million, and it's making something. And so help me understand how that applies to me as – in my statement.
Well, if you have stocks, first of all, your statement is probably in terms of asset value, not cash. There's a part of the statement that's cash, hopefully, but chances are what you're seeing is value. And the reality is, if you see $40,000 of value, stock value, that equals $0 in real money. Value is something that comes from the exchange of money. It is an abstract number. That's why it literally can just jump up and down any given day, depending on whatever the market conditions or whatever the market does. On the other hand, money, real cash, is something that is real and possessible, as in you can possess it. The value comes from the exchange of money. It is fundamentally different from the money that is actually being exchanged. So when people see these statements, as you say, with like $1 million of value, that's not money, dude. you got, when you own stocks, the first thing you do is you get rid of the money that you have and you don't have any more money. And then you hope to get it back later on from somebody else. And the valuation formula, I want to add with a, sorry to bring it through on a silly math example, but the valuation formula itself is also very flawed. Okay.
Okay.
I'm going to give you a quick example real quick. For example, Google, I believe, has about 800 million shares outstanding. Let's say 400 million shares for the C class shares, 400 million shares. All right. If it's trading at, let's say, $1,000, right? Now, if I buy just one share for one more dollar, so $1,001, okay? That $1 additional I contributed to the price of Google will be multiplied 400 million times, okay? So what I'm saying is, if you do the math, the actual market cap formula, the valuation formula, is price, last price, times the number of shares in your portfolio or for the whole market. If somebody just buys, because the shares are never 100% traded, usually liquidity is less than 1%. So that one price for really less than 1% of shares is automatically distributed to the entire shares, all the shares that are outstanding, which is fundamentally flawed, because if I buy just one share of Google for $1,001, for $1 more than the last price, that $1 will be increased, will be multiplied by 400 million shares, and all of Google investors as a whole will see an increase in their net worth of, to the tune of $400 million, even though I just contributed $1. That shows a flaw.
So, okay, very interesting. So to break that down, what I hear you saying is, is not only is there a flaw in the in their system, but one thing you say in the Ponzi factor is that now there's a large percentage of stock businesses that the stock on the business, the dividend isn't even tied. So if Bob buys into Google,
right,
he's not even getting a dividend. Right?
Right, right, right. So,
tell me more about that.
Okay, sure. So let's actually get to the heart of the book, because that's what the heart of the book is about, which is there's two ways you make money from stocks. One is dividends, which is the money you actually receive from the company, from the business itself. And another is capital gains, which is this whole buy low, sell high thing. You buy Google for $1,000, you sell it for $1,100. Cool, right? Except for one thing, the capital gains aspect, most people don't quite understand, is that when you sell, when you buy for $1,000 and you sell it for $1,100, that $1,100 does not come from Google. It comes from another investor. That person will then have to sell it for more than $1,100 to get his or her money back. So basically, it's a system that shuffles money between investors with fees in between every single transaction. So it's by nature negative sum. And the most important aspect of what that implies is Google never pays the shareholders. That's the ultimate problem with the scenario, is that when there are no dividends, investors receive nothing from the companies they own.
It's so fascinating. So, and back when the stock market started, when Axos was formed, the business was actually tied to the stock. So if me, Bob, now obviously my name is Blake, but if me, Bob, the investor, goes and buys $1 million worth of, you know, let's just call it Google for this matter. Back in the world when the stocks began, I would actually truly own a portion of the company, right?
Correct.
What's changed?
What's changed? So stocks initially started around the 1600s. And basically up until the 1900s, they all paid dividends, because that's just how you're supposed to make money. You're supposed to buy a piece of a company, and when they make money, you get a piece of profits. Real simple, end of story. Sometime around the mid-1900s, and this is not very clearly documented at all, because finance people don't actually care about this type of information. Dividends completely disappeared, or not completely, but a lot of non-dividend stocks started appearing. And And now, obviously, it seems like normal. Yeah, they don't have to pay dividends. What the hell are you talking about, dude? What do you mean the company doesn't have to pay the shareholder? Now it's just normal, right? But the thing is, around the 1960s or 50s, non-dividend stocks started popping up. And these Ponzi assets, as I call them, now pretty much dominate the market. And people are justifying their existence when, in reality, the truth is supposed to be very simple. You buy a piece of a company, they make money, you make money. Not you buy a piece of paper, they make money, you get nothing, and maybe you could sell that paper to some other douchebag, okay? So, which is exactly how it works now. And the finance junkies I debate with basically defend this bigger fool's idea. Oh, the company doesn't have to pay you. You just get your money from someone else. It's like, are you guys, how far deep are you in the Kool-Aid? Okay, very, very deep. But yeah, that's the reality we live in. And I also want to address one thing about buybacks, because this comes up a lot. Stock buybacks are seen or actually portrayed often as returns to investors as an alternative dividend, meaning the company buys back their shares. That is not a return to investors, because these companies who buy back stocks have the option and often do just print more stocks after the buyback without announcing anything. If you hear CNBC talk about buybacks returning $1 trillion to investors, they are not talking about, they do not mention dilution, which is all the shares they issued without telling anybody, without announcing anything.
Okay, so let's break that down. So, you know, I've got $1 million in the market, and where the stock that I have, it looks like they're buying tons of my stock back. And so, you know, on paper, big picture, you know, I'm not taking any money out, but it looks like on paper, I'm going to make a lot of money. But what you're telling me is they also then add a zero, dilute the stock, print electric numbers. And then it's basically a way of manipulation. I don't really get anything back for it. They just actually cooked the books and made their numbers look really good.
Yeah, basically they say, oh yeah, we're buying back stocks, except for why aren't you telling people, or more importantly, why isn't the media reporting it when you're diluting? Every time a company issues stock options to employees, as in paying employees with stocks, that's total BS. There's no such thing as paying your employees with stocks, because your employees don't want stocks, okay? They want money. They're going to take those stocks and get it from another and sell to another investor to get their money back. So there is no real thing as stock compensation. It's all just printing stocks to employees, which adds to the dilution. So a real simple, obvious example is Morgan Stanley, AT&T. These are dinosaurs that have been around for almost a century. If their buybacks were legitimate, they shouldn't have any more stocks by now. They should have bought them out. But they should bought them all back by now. A lot of these, so obviously stocks, there's something very wrong with the whole idea of stock buybacks returning to money to investors, is because they just simply print more. So I've been talking about dividends, I've been talking about capital gains, but I do need to address that, because that does come up and it is often falsely portrayed as a return to investor. And I will also mention that what I just described about buybacks is not like my own so-called theory. It is a known fact for anyone who's done equity risk premium research, which is actually research in a niche topic about the historic returns from stocks. So anyone who does any real deep research like that, which I've done, by the way, we understand and we do treat buybacks with dilution. We don't ignore the dilution aspect of it.
It's very interesting. And so what you're saying is, the truth is, Bob could actually make money in the market. He could lose money in the market. But whether he's making money or losing money, it has nothing to do with the company who he thinks he's actually involved with. It's actually just other people on the merry-go-round, and they're actually just getting excited or deciding to move out or getting excited. And so they're buying at a higher price or a lower price. And one, the money managers are making a fee every single time something happens. The stock market's making a fee. The stock's making a fee every time something happens. And then if I'm selling and I'm making money, or in whatever I'm in, if I'm making money, it's tied to the merry-go-round, not the actual companies in the market.
No, very true. Very true. That's exactly it. Because what I want to point out is there a connection between the stock price and the underlying company? Yeah, it's called a speculative connection. It is not a legal one. It is not a logical one. It is not a monetary one because you get no money from the company. Now, there is a speculative connection, though. But then again, everything in the world under the sun has speculative connections, okay? And I will say there are some stocks that move more speculatively in line with the fundamentals versus other Ponzi assets that are completely out of whack, like for Tesla Motors, for example. The company's lost $6 billion in the past 10 years, and the stock has went from $20 to $800 while they lost $10 billion. And who knows, maybe they're going to lose another $10 billion 20 years from, you know, next 10 years, and the stock's going to go to $2,000, okay? But it basically, that defies logic. And of course, the finance junkies are going to say, well, it's about future value. It's about, you know, future expectations. No, but the point is, if the stock is actually monetarily connected with the cash flows in the company, that cannot logically happen ever, okay? Right. And it's not just Tesla. There's Shopify. There's Wayfair. List goes on and on. I have a whole list of them. But also, the reverse is also true. You also have these situations with stocks staying relatively flat, and investors ultimately make nothing over a period of time when the company makes billions and billions of dollars. Google, for example, is a great example of that. 2007, 2011, stock remained, I think, around 700 or something. It's an example in my book. And the company made $28 billion during that period of time. So as a shareholder, you would have got nothing for holding that thing for 4 years, but the company received $28 billion. And same with, you know, Berkshire and a whole bunch of other companies, same thing.
Yeah. So all you have is what you're saying. All you got is a speculative price change. And mm-hmm. and whatever the price went up to during that, from 2007 to 2011, the speculation of that number is all the statement's going to show of your value, but it's just thin air because it's not backed by collateral.
No, you get nothing from the company. And, you know, some people say, oh, yeah, you're just cherry picking dates. No, dude, if I want to cherry pick dates, I could tell you periods of time when investors would have lost money with Google while they made $28 billion, while they would have lost money. All right, exactly. So I'm actually very neutral saying, hey, they made no money. But if I want to cherry pick, I got cherry pick, and I ain't a cherry pick there.
Right. So fascinating. Okay, so, you know, our listeners are those who are in the, they own businesses, they're an executive, they could just be the hard worker they're just throwing money in a 401, an IRA, and now they're kind of waking up because now they're like, you know, I'm actually to a point where I need to start paying attention. I need to know what I'm going to have in the future. I need to know retirement-wise, can I retire? Should I continue to work? Like, I just don't even know. And so this is great education. This is like, this is tangible stuff that they can actually start processing of, you know, I want to have something that I can count on. I want to have something backed by something. So tell me more about, you know, so the bold statement of Ponzi factor is bold, and you just kind of broken down, sliced through of why that's a, you know, this Ponzi asset is actually what it is. Mm-hmm. But just for a little bit more clarity, define why would you call it a Ponzi asset, the stock market?
Why do I call it a Ponzi asset? You mean non-dividends?
Right.
Stocks? Well, because stocks are seen as an asset, okay, as a thing. And an asset is technically something you buy and you're supposed to sell for more money, right? Which real estate, yeah, that's an asset. But the thing is, it's real, okay? You don't just print a house, okay? Whereas Google prints millions and billions of shares. And freaking Tesla, their shares outstanding have doubled since 2010 when they went public. They printed like 100 million shares over the past 10 years. Ponzi asset, meaning it's literally imaginary. It takes no effort to produce, and you think it's an asset, but really you get it's not a real asset. It's something that you can only get from selling it to a bigger fool, just like you, in a system that shuffles money between investors. And there's no intrinsic value in it, whether you want to believe that there is or not. So that's why I call it a Ponzi asset, because it meets the definition of Ponzi scheme, too.
Right. Right. I love that. Okay. So help us understand, what's not a Ponzi asset?
Well, let's think about dividend stocks. You actually receive money from the underlying business. Therefore, you're not just getting your money from another investor through the Ponzi process. You're also getting money from the underlying business itself. So they would not be considered Ponzi assets. Also something that may have intrinsic value, whether it's, for example, a house. The value of the house, yeah, the only way you get your money back is by selling the house to another person. But until that happens, what are you doing with that? You're living in it. You got a roof over your head. There's non-monetary values involved as well. We could also look at bonds. Okay, bonds, the borrower who issues a bond promises to pay you back. You're going to get your money back with interest from the actual borrower, not from selling it to, you know, somebody else. Ultimately, the bond is backed by the borrower. The issue with stocks, especially Google and these non-dividends, they're not backed. That's one of the biggest fallacies ever out there, is that stocks are backed by the underlying company. That idea that it's backed comes from the hypothetical assumption that one day they might get acquired and pay back the shareholder. One day they might liquidate and go out of business and pay back the shareholders. True, they might happen, but we don't know when and how. And for something to be really backed, okay, is, I usually say this to people, if Google stocks are backed, then tell me how much it's backed by and how much and when investors will see that money. If it's backed and I buy for $1,100 and it drops to $900, can I go to Google and say, hey, I lost $200, give me back? Hell no. Okay. Nor are they going to buy it from me for $900. So how the heck is it backed? We can't just say, oh, it's backed without any kind of relevance of how they're actually backed and when investors are actually going to get their money back. And that's the issue with these Ponzi assets and these myths in the stock market. Oh, it's backed by the assets. Yeah. If I lose $200, can I, like, you know, per share, can I go ask Google, sell that beachfront property? And because I want to, you know, get some of those asset money back. It's like, right. No, in practice, it's nonsense.
Yeah. And I really appreciate that, because that's, you know, and as a Solomon investor, we talk a lot about that Solomon investors are backed by collateral. Solomon investors activate their net worth. And to activate your net worth, you've got to have it backed by something. It's got to be collateralized. And that collateral removes it from the speculation world and removes your actual return from the emotions of another. It actually backs it by the business. And the three-dimensional investment of a Solomon investor is one that actually is the land. It actually is tangible business, and it actually cash flows. And man, I appreciate you breaking that down, because it's as wild as it is, it's just so overlooked by a money manager, by a accountant, by a CPA.
Yeah. Money managers will be out of business if they reveal what I revealed.
It's very true. I mean, it's typically one who, unfortunately, either doesn't know how it actually works or has been trained to sell the asset a certain way. As you mentioned, you know, in the hedge fund world, as the curtain was pulled back, you realize, oh my goodness, I'm trying to offer a world-class customer service here, but unfortunately I didn't realize it's not even backed by anything. Yeah. So I love that. Man, we got so much to cover, and I tell you what I want to do. I want to actually do a whole nother episode with you and dive into some more of the nuts and bolts of this, and you know, help people really break free of that mindset that they just have to stay in the market. They just have to do it because, no, but they can have freedom. They can have tangible freedom and actually build wealth with sustainable, with, you know, backed by collateral. If they want to find more about you, find more about the Ponzi Factor book, how can they get a hold of you?
Well, they can go to theponzifactor.com. That's the website, and they can email me from there. Or they can find me on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter as well. I have a YouTube channel. I post some videos. I do have to apologize on my Twitter feeds that it's got a little more political than I like. But so I got to give a little warning there. But the easiest way is to get in touch with me through those channels and through email. From the PosiFactor.com website itself.
Very good. Don, I so appreciate you, man. I appreciate, you know, you being backed by optics and metrics. I love that you have a heart and your wiring to analyze things, to find truth, to shine light on something. And more than anything, to actually, if something's not just, if something's not done right, I mean, just say what it is. If it's, you know what, your yes be yes, your no be no. And that allows people to be invested into something they actually count, so they can actually know what they're, you know, if it's not collateralized, they need to know it. They just need to know ahead of time going into it. So I appreciate your heart in that. This is a Salman Investor Podcast. Stay tuned. I have another episode with Tom, and he's going to break down some more of the economics and how you can actually build wealth in your investments. Stay tuned.
All right, guys, here comes the thanks and the shout outs. We want to thank everyone that leaves reviews and the written reviews on Apple, Spotify, and all the other platforms. Just know they mean the world to us. If you've taken the 30 to 60 seconds, you know, extra seconds to show love and to give context of why this has been worthwhile for you and why this podcast has helped you, we thank you. We're going to give a couple shout outs of our favorite reviews each podcast. So please give us some love with a 5-star review. And thank you for joining the Salman Investor Revolution.